Welcome to The Rest is History, which comes not inappropriately from Greece, or at least partly from Greece. The historian Herodotus tells the story of the Battle of Thermopylae, when the Spartans made their heroic stand against the Persian king Xerxes. And afterwards, when the Persians had wiped the floor with the Spartans, they asked a group of Greek deserters why there were so few Greeks at the battlefield. And the deserters supposedly replied that the rest of the Greeks were off at the Olympic Games watching the horse racing. The Persians asked what was their prize, what was the point? And the Greeks said the prize was a crown of olive leaves. And at that, the Persians supposedly cried out and gnashed their teeth and rent their garments and said, "What kind of men are these that we're fighting against? They fight not for riches, but for glory." Now, another person who fights only for glory is my collaborator, Tom Holland, the translator of Herodotus's histories. No less. Tom, you're very keen on the Olympics, aren't you? I imagine you're dying to see the kickoff in Tokyo. You can't wait.
Well, I'm very keen on the ancient Olympics. I actually find the modern ones
they're rubbish,
boring,
aren't they?
To be honest.
The synchronized swimming doesn't do it for you, or powerlifting,
really,
or whatever it
not
is?
Not really. But the ancient ones are fantastic, and I'm incredibly jealous of you being in Greece right now as we record
this.
Yes. And very grateful that you have broken off from Downing Retsina in the
exactly
the shade of Mycenae, flesh pots of Napoleon,
in the flesh pots of the Peloponnese. Exactly.
Yes.
So what I've actually done exactly, I've broken off my holiday to be lectured by you about ancient religion, and I said to my wife as she went off taking my son for an ice cream, I said basically for the next hour Tom Holland will be just using the word sacral again and again and again.
I will.
I know exactly what's coming.
You know me too well. Have you, before we get on to the sacral quality of the ancient Olympic Games, am I going to major on that? Have you haven't actually been to Olympia, though, this
holiday? No, although I've never been. Although yesterday we went to Nemea, which is another games location. And so there's a brilliant tunnel. They've sort of reconstructed, I think, the tunnel that the athletes, it's very like, you know, stepping onto the field for the World Cup final or something. You go through the tunnel and you emerge into the stadium, and you get a fantastic sense of what it was like. I mean, in the sort of, I know that's a silly thing to say because you don't really know what it was like, but you can sort of pretend anyway. I played the final countdown on my phone, so and got my son to run through the tunnel. Because of course there's nobody else here because of COVID, so it's brilliant. You get it all to yourself,
and you win the crown.
Exactly, the olive wreath.
So you mentioned the Nemean Games.
Yeah, so, there were four, weren't there?
Well, there are lots of games, but there are four games where basically, as in the story that you read from Herodotus, you get a crown. So they're called the Stephanic Games, Stephanos,
right,
being Greek for a crown. So the Nemean Games was basically ranked fourth.
You're telling me I've been to the... I didn't even get on the podium.
You didn't even podium.
the Nemean Games and not even the bronze medal of games. That's so disappointing. Oh, my God.
The Isthmian. The Isthmian is the bronze one. So that's at Corinth. The Isthmian is joining the Peloponnese, the southern kind of fork of Greece, to the mainland. Then the Pythian, which is at Delphi. And then the Olympian. And Pausanias, who is 2nd century AD, basically he kind of writes travel guides. He writes a travel guide to Greece.
The rough guide.
The rough guide. And he says of the Olympic Games, they are the greatest of games. And so that's why the modern games are named after them, because they are the pinnacle.
Well, did Pausanias, you're not claiming that he invented the idea that the Olympic Games were the best. I mean, were they genuinely the best? And the
no, greatest? He said that they rank first. They come top.
Okay.
If you win at the Olympic Games, then that's absolutely the best. Although the mark of a really elite athlete, and you know how keen I am on elite sport, is to get the Grand Slam, a bit like kind of tennis now. You know, you get.
And this
Grand
is, of course, what Nero did, right? Well, I'm sure we'll come to this later on.
That is what Nero did. But, and I know how much you've been looking forward to me using the word sacral.
Yes, come on. Let's get it over with.
Okay, so the key, really, the fundamental difference between the modern Olympic Games, which, as constituted now, is basically about money. I mean, the reason that they're going ahead in a time of COVID, it's not because of the Olympic spirit. It's not because of the amity of nations. It's because of TV deals.
Yeah, well, we're going to do the modern Olympics, aren't we, in another podcast, so we can do all the sleaze and the politics of it.
But the episode you mentioned with Thermopylae, the Persians are invading Greece. you know, yeah. This is a massive crisis. Holding the pass at Thermopylae is the best option the Greeks have to stop the Persian advance. But they don't go because of the games. And that's not because they're obsessed by sport, although they are. It's because the Olympic Games have this incredible status as something that is holy to the gods. And so again, Pausanias, when he goes to Olympia and he says about the games that there are basically the two holiest events in Greece. One is the mysteries at Eleusis, which is just outside Athens, where it's involved with the story of Demeter and Persephone going into the underworld and then coming back for 6 months and going back. And it's all basically about life and death. So it's absolutely, you know, at the heart of everything that a mortal might want to learn. But he says that the festival of the Olympics are on that level. And actually, when I say Olympic Games as a synonym for festival, that's wrong, because the games are only a part of the broader festival.
Let's go back to the origins. So when did their conventional date is 776, isn't it? And we get that from Aristotle, am I right? That he says it was 776 BC?
Yes, well, we get it also from a guy called Hippias of Elis. And Elis is the kind of the town that over the course of history comes to kind of monopolize and lay claim to the games and the festival. And essentially, if you win the sprint, which is the first race, and it's won by this butcher, supposedly, called Coroebus.
Right.
Then
nice.
From that point on, your name as the guy who wins the sprint, this is how the Greeks date. This is the dating system that they use. So it's kind of, I mean, how elite is that? You win a sprint and then your name, you know, is going to be used forever after by people drawing up histories and
to interject on this, we were in Sparta the other day in modern Sparta, which is, as my son said, is not it doesn't quite live up to his image of ancient Sparta. But in the middle of modern Sparta, there is a monument, an Olympic monument, and it has the names of every Spartan who won the Olympics, going back to, you know, the 8th century BC or whatever it is, and coming right up to the early 21st century. And I thought, I mean, they're basically pretending there's no break. They're pretending that the Olympic Games are the same thing and that Sparta. So yes. I loved that there was a sort of, that they're still remembering these guys, you know, 2,500 years ago, and they still got this sort of monument to their Spartan Olympic heroes. So the names do live forevermore.
Well, yes. Yes, absolutely. And so Greek contenders knew that, I mean, the fame that you win is in a sense the kind of the key to it. But it won't surprise you to know that there are complications. So one of them is, you know, is this true? And actually the kind of the weight of opinion is probably that it vaguely is.
What, the butcher did win and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, perhaps, who knows? I mean, we've got no way really of knowing, but it seems feasible. But this kind of, you know, we can recognize that's a historical account. But for the Greeks, this, and I'm afraid I'm going to use the word, the sacral quality of the game.
Here we go. Yeah. I'm so glad you did that, Tom. I mean, it would be disappointing if you didn't.
I know. It's interwoven with myth.
Okay.
And so you can basically, with the Greeks, you can hold, you know, kind of three or four ideas simultaneously in your head. So you can have this idea that there is a kind of recognizable starting point that you get on the blocks. You know, firing gun goes and you're off. The games have begun. But at the same time, you also have to kind of enmesh it in your ideas about the stories told of the gods and the heroes. And as is always the way with Greece, there is no definitive account. So it's held at Olympia. Olympia, obviously, there's the resonance with Olympus, the home of the gods, where Zeus, the king of the gods, rules. And it's Zeus.
Is it named after Olympus, Tom? Is it named after Mount Olympus, the place? Or?
Well, it's named after Olympian Zeus. So Zeus presides over the games. And so therefore, one of the stories that's told about the origins of the games, and again, going back to Pausanias, who really is a kind of, you know, the crucial source for this, he says, some say Zeus wrestled there at Olympia with Cronos himself for the throne of heaven. Some say he held the games as a celebration of his triumph. And Cronos was Zeus's father. There was a prediction that he would be toppled by his child. And so he devours his children as they're born. And he gets tricked because Zeus's mother gives him a stone wrapped in swaddling clothes, and Zeus is then able to live and comes and defeats him. So that is kind of pinning the origins of the Olympics right to the beginning of the reign of the Olympians, the coming of the Olympians. So that's the kind of measure of its significance.
But Tom, I read this story, I read it only today, that Pelops,
yes,
the son of Tantalus, a man who had survived being eaten by the gods, being served to the gods as food by his own father, which is not a claim many of us can make. But he had done this and lived to tell the tale, that he had a chariot race with his prospective father-in-law in which he replaced the linchpins in the wheels of his father-in-law's chariot with wax so that they melted and he died. And he then held funeral games to remember his sort of father-in-law, which became the Olympics. Is that not the origin of the games?
So that's another story. Yeah, and that's the one that actually kind of wins. I say you can keep all these different ideas in your head. So it matters to identify the origins with Zeus. But yes, absolutely. Pelops, who gives his name to the Peloponnese, where you are sitting now.
Yeah.
And actually, there's a link to the Eleusinian mysteries there as well, because the one god who eats a bit of Pelops is Demeter, because she's in mourning for Persephone, who's just been abducted by Hades, the king of the underworld. And so from that point on, the gods kind of reconstitute him back to life. From that point on, he has an ivory shoulder to replace the bit that Demeter had snapped. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so he's from Anatolia. He crosses the Aegean. He comes to what will come to be called the Peloponnese, the island of Pelops. And he goes to a place called Pisa, which isn't the place of the Leaning Tower in Italy. It's about a mile from where the games, where Olympia will be. And absolutely, yes. So there's a guy called Oinomaus, who's the king there. And he has a daughter, Hippodamia. And a bit like Cronos having been told that he will be killed by a son, Oinomaus has been told that he will be killed by the man who marries his daughter. And so he's not keen on this. And so every suitor, he challenges a suitor to a chariot race with the proviso that if the guy who wins the chariot race loses, he can be killed. And so Pelops arrives, and they're welcoming him to Pisa above the palace of his prospective father-in-law, a kind of, a rack of skulls of the decaying heads, the flesh dripping off.
From a lot of us are very familiar with those kinds of scenes with our own fathers-in-law.
Yes. So he obviously is twitchy, but he's got advantages, because he's got winged steeds that are a gift from the gods. So that's a kind of advantage. But he wants to make absolutely sure. And so he bribes his father, prospective father-in-law's charioteer, a guy called Myrtilos, to exactly, as you say, replace the spokes with the that. What are they? The axle,
yeah,
thing to keep the wheels in, with wax. And so the father dies. Pelops marries and is a great hero, but he has bribed Myrtilos. He's said, I'll give you all kinds of goodies. And Myrtilos comes to Pelops for his reward. And did you read what Pelops does?
Does he kill him?
He does. Chucks him over a cliff.
Well, that's harsh, isn't it? That's bad.
It is
form.
Harsh.
It's very
it is
bad
harsh.
Form.
So Pelops is, he's not a nice guy.
No, I'm feeling bad about being in the Peloponnese now.
Well, no, but so Pelops reigns, it's all great, but there is a curse that's been put on his family. And I know you just went to Mycenae, didn't you?
Yes, House of Atreus. So
is this Atreus the house is the son of Pelops.
So Agamemnon, Clytemnestra, Electra, all that stuff.
All that
stems from this disastrous chariot race. Well,
yes.
Not disastrous for Pelops, but disastrous for his successors.
Exactly, yes. And so you have there the sense that, in sport we talk about heroes, a lot of talk about heroes.
Yeah.
A hero in Greece is something faintly menacing. It's someone who's kind of has a touch of the divine, and the divine is always dangerous. So yeah. Pelops is not a pleasant guy. I mean, he's a cheat. He's really not pleasant at all. And yet he has
something of the night about him.
Something of the strange, something of the kind of demonic in the Greek sense.
Right.
And that sense of the strange and the weird hangs over the games that then kind of emerge.
So there's a sense of the games being expiating sin, do you think? Is that too strong?
I think that is too strong. I think the key is that the age of heroes has passed. So it passes with the Trojan War. But you come to Olympia, and if you're watching the chariot races or the wrestling or whatever, and you see astounding performances, you are as close to the Age of Heroes as you possibly can be in the Age of Iron that we all live in. And that's the fascination of it, that it's kind of opening up a portal to the weird. So you've got Zeus is one of the founders, Pelops is the other, the third one is Heracles, you know, with his 12 labors. And the other story is that he comes there after he's finished his labors, and he institutes the games, and he sacrifices a black ram before the tomb of Pelops. And this is something that they do every 4 years at the games. They sacrifice a ram to Pelops. And, you know, you are kind of taking part in these incredibly vivid stories. They are alive and a part of what you were doing. And that is absolutely fundamental to everything that the Olympics in antiquity are about.
So just to get away from the myth for a second, where did the idea of games come from? Is it something the Greeks have got from, where have they got it from? From Crete, from Egypt, from Anatolia, or do they invent it? Are the games in other places?
I think it's an expression of a kind of obsession with being best. So the Greeks can make a contest out of anything. You know, they can make a contest out of, well, you know, famously plays, so tragedian,
poetry and
comedies,
stuff.
Poetry, but kind of beauty contests, weaving. I mean, there's absolutely nothing that the Greeks can't make into a contest.
And I wouldn't pay to see the weaving contest.
But if you're a Greek, you might. And particularly, you know, if it's kind of a Athena against Arachne, and you know that the loser is going to be turned into a spider.
I mean, that's true. Well, I'd definitely pay to see that.
Yeah. So that's the measure. There's jeopardy in everything. And it kind of reflects the way in which, you know, the Greeks, you know, they don't have, they have no concept of sport for sport's sake. So we were talking about podiuming, the idea of gold, silver and bronze. But basically, there is no bronze or silver. You win or you lose. And when you win, one of the perks you get is you get to commission a kind of victory hymn. So it's kind of like, you know, it's like, I don't know, getting Beyonce or somebody to celebrate your victory in 100 meters, something like that, Rihanna. And the famous guy who does this in ancient Greece is a guy called Pindar from Thebes.
Is he a playwright, Pindar?
No, he writes these odes, these kind of victories. Oh, okay. That's what he's chiefly known for. And he has this. So as much as he's writing in praise of the winner, he's also writing about the losers. While you were sunning yourself in Greece yesterday, I had this disastrous game of cricket where I got out for naught.
That always happens to you, Tom, doesn't it? Then you always go out.
Not always. I bowled the over that lost us the game. It was an absolute disaster. And I came back and was reading some Pindar in preparation for this episode. And I came across this about the losers, where Pindar writes, "No joyous homecoming for them on their return to their mothers. No sweet laughter, no surge of joy. Down dark alleyways they slink, avoiding their enemies, gnawed at by the consciousness of their defeat."
Oh, and Tom, my heart bleeds for you.
I know.
You've clearly been through a dark night of the soul after this cricket match.
I have. But so there's none of this, you know, plucky British contender coming in eighth kind of thing. So,
right, yeah.
Anyone who comes in second is a loser. And you slink back in disgrace.
Exactly. Some gallant Scottish long-distance runner trailing in fifth. No good.
Absolutely no good at all. Absolutely no good. So I think that it's that kind of ambition to be the best.
So there's no Corinthian spirit. The Corinthian spirit is a total British invention. There was no such thing as the Corinthian spirit in ancient Greece.
No, that's a kind of, so that amateur spirit, the Greeks have no word for amateur either. That strain within the modern Olympics is, well, it comes, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about that when we get onto our program about the modern Olympics. Yeah. It comes from Shropshire, doesn't it? It's a British invention.
Shropshire and the Cotswolds, two places I know very well, are basically the cradles of the modern Olympics. But we will come onto that later on. Tom, but the athletes who are, they have no word for amateur, but the athletes that are participating are amateurs, aren't they? They're not professionals, surely.
Well, you have to train for 10 months. And you have okay. to, for one of those months, you have to do it at Ellis. And it's true, you don't get paid for your victory. But when you go back, you know, you're guaranteed all kinds of perks and goodies and sponsorship deals and things like that.
Yeah. Yes. Tea companies will queue up to employ you as an influencer, as so, is the case with podcast presenters.
Exactly. It you know, it requires time and money to do that.
Yeah.
So Kuroibos, for instance, you know, the butcher, he's unusual because generally butchers don't have time to have 10 months to train for a sprint.
So by and large, are the contestants are they rich?
They tend to be very rich, yeah. You know, that's a bit like today, isn't it? Because it tends to be wealthy countries that win the most medals.
Of course, people often say too many public schoolboys and all this kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. So it's exactly the same. And then, of course, there's the further dimension, which is that in the hippodrome, so the chariot racing and the riding on horseback, the person who gets the medal isn't the person who's driving the chariot or the person who's riding the horse. It's the person who owns the horses. So horses are much more valuable.
This is something I really wanted to ask you about, because I was looking at the list of famous winners, and I saw that, for example, Arsinoe II, queen of Ptolemaic Egypt, had won the chariot race. And I thought, really? I thought women weren't allowed to participate in the Olympics, but clearly she had sponsored or whatever, some other chariot racer. And of course, Philip of Macedon, his horse won on the day, supposedly, when Alexander the Great was born, but he wasn't racing it himself. So it's rather like the Queen's horse winning, you know, the Derby or whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we should go to a break, but just quickly on the issue of women. So women are not allowed to compete, and they're not even allowed to go into the sanctuary. And married women are not allowed to go to the festival full stop. So it's very sexist.
Hold on, married women aren't, but single women are.
Well, kind of, yes. So prostitutes are allowed to go. High-class courtesans, unmarried virgins, although since it's a massive kind of whore fest, by and large, unmarried virgins tend not to go there.
Right.
But definitely, you know, as a woman, you're not allowed to compete. But the one way that you can compete is to enter chariots. And so the very first woman to win in the Olympic Games is a Spartan, and I'm sure her name would have been on that list of Spartan victors, called Kyniska, who enters a chariot in 396, wins again 4 years later in the next bout of the Games. And she has this kind of wonderful inscription which survived. It says, "My father and brothers were kings of Sparta. I proclaim myself the only woman in all of Greece to have won the crown." So she's commemorated as a kind of great hero of the Olympics. But there's one other woman who plays a key role, which is a woman called Phrynike, who's kind of part of this great boxing tradition.
Is she a boxer?
No, she's not. But she belongs to this. She's kind of married to one who's an Olympic champion. His grandfather, his father was, his brothers were, and his son is training to become one as well. And the son's father. So this son is, he's called Pisidorus. He's from Rhodes. He's in busy training for the games, and his father dies, and his father's been training him. So he's stuck. You know, who's he going to have to train him? And then this mysterious figure appears, cloaked in a white cloak. Oh. And he assumes that it's a god or a hero who's come to coach him. Coaching goes through, you know, they do their 9 months training in Rhodes, they go to Olympia, they do their months training in Elis, and then the procession to Olympia, they settle down in the village. The time comes for the game. Pisidorus he wins the final bout, and the trainer, who's kind of cloaked and hooded, is so excited that he leaps over the fence, and of course they like Scotsmen, they don't wear pants, they don't wear underwear, and everyone is able to see that this mysterious figure is in fact a woman, and it turns out to be Phrynike, whose name aptly enough means bringer of victory. And this is a capital offence. If you are a woman and you're found at the games, you get chucked off a mountaintop.
Oh yeah, that's harsh.
So they're brought before the Olympic judges, and you know, they're deciding, well, what are we going to do? And they decide that because she is from this great dynasty, this great sporting dynasty, they can't possibly chuck her off a cliff. And so they say, okay, we'll let you off. You will be the one woman who has trained an Olympic champion.
The exception that proves the rule.
But they institute a new rule, which is that from this point on, not only the athletes, but also the trainers have to perform in the nude.
Oh, my word. That is hilarious.
And I mean, who wouldn't like to see that? I think Tokyo, wouldn't you? I mean, it'd be great fun.
The trainers and the athletes in the nude.
Yeah. I mean, imagine the sunburn.
That's true, but I probably wouldn't pay to see some of those kind of, I don't know, Eastern European heavyweights.
Hair sprouting in all kinds of peculiar places. Yes. Well, I think on that shocking note.
Yeah, no stereotype goes unused on this podcast. Right, we should take a break, shouldn't we? We should leave you with that image. We should take a break and we'll return. I think we should talk about the politics. I think we should talk about the Olympic truce. I think we should talk about famous Olympians. We've got tons to discuss. See you in a minute.
Okay.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking about the ancient Olympics to coincide with the Tokyo Olympics, or at least we think there's going to be a Tokyo Olympics. There's still a sort of hint of doubt at the time that we're recording this, but I think we'll put it out anyway. So, Tom, something that absolutely fascinates me and I think has fascinated lots of people about the ancient Olympics is this sort of political dimension, and particularly the idea of the Olympic truce, that it marks a kind of... whether it marks a cessation of hostilities between the city-states or whether you just can't take weapons into the Olympics or what. So explain exactly what's going on.
It's more like an armistice. So war carries on. That's why the Olympics, they play them in 480 when the Persians are invading, and they play them throughout the Peloponnesian War and so on. But essentially it means that, if you're an Athenian or you're a Spartan, you can go to the Olympics and you will meet and you will compete and everyone will accept your right to be there. And that's the kind of ideal. It's kind of pan-Hellenic. That's the great ideal. I think, in the context of the Greek world where they are endlessly fighting each other, it is the one chance for enemies to meet up and to kind of, to that extent, feel a certain degree of kind of kinship.
That question of kinship is really interesting. So is the mark of being a Greek whether or not you can go to the Olympics? So do the Greek colonies in Asia Minor, in Sicily, in Italy and so on, do they send people to the Olympics?
Yeah,
they do.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You have to be freeborn Greek, basically.
Do you have to speak Greek? Do you have to prove your Greek?
Absolutely, you have to speak Greek, yes. And the judges decide whether you can compete or not. You'll know that there's kind of a disagreement about whether the Macedonians, say, are Greek.
Yes. Yeah.
But by and large, yes, it's for freeborn Greeks. So Greek speakers. Yes, and absolutely. I mean, some of the greatest champions come from Sicily, say. And so they all meet up. The trainers and the athletes will have been at Elis for a month practicing there. And then I think it's the kind of the first or second full moon after the summer solstice. And when that comes, you set off from Elis. It's a kind of about 35 miles to Olympia. Takes you 2 days. The route is marked by various rituals. So there's an awful lot of sacrificing of pigs at the Olympics.
Right. So it's bad news for pigs.
It's terrible news for pigs. And it's also terrible news for oxen, which we'll come to in due course. You go past a sacred spring, you kill a pig. You come to a place where some hero did something, you kill a pig. And you all arrive at the Olympic Village. And so Olympia is not, it's not a city. So it's kind of like Glastonbury. It's a great festival. It's a great feel.
They stay in tents, don't they? Do they all sleep in tents?
They all sleep in tents or not at all. You sleep out in the open. It's incredibly hot. It's incredibly dusty. There are no toilet facilities. So it's even worse than Glastonbury.
But here's a question about the heat. So I'm in Greece right now. It's incredibly hot, mid to late 30s. They are competing in the heat of summer. Is that why they're naked? Or is the nakedness to do with the worship of the human body kind of thing?
Well, the story is that there's a contender and his loincloth slips off while he's running and it kind of improves his performance. And so everyone goes for it. I mean, that's the story that gets told. Pausanias is rather cynical about it. It says that he, this contender says that it slipped off, but actually he'd realized them, thrown it aside to get this competitive advantage. I mean, it's you know, it's very homoerotic. I mean, there's a lot of kind of ogling and eyeing people up. And one of the things that the Olympic Games offer is, you know, that we have male and female different contenders. They divide it up between men and boys. So the first round of games is actually the boys. The first day they run, wrestle, box.
When you say boys, what, teenagers?
Kind of up to the age of 20. But you know, there are no birth certificates, so it's up to the judges. So there's always the risk if you're a boy and you've entered the boxing and the judge says, actually, you're a man and you're up against some terrifying man mountain. I mean, you know, run away. So it's always it's always a kind of risk. So that's what happens on the first day. And also the boys compete. And also you swear an oath. You swear an oath before Zeus. You swear it over a dismembered pig.
Pigs again. What have the Greeks got against pigs?
And if you cheat, so this doesn't happen very often, but it happens occasionally, you will be fined and the fines will go to make a bronze of you, and your shame will then, you know, it'll be put up publicly and it'll be there forevermore.
So what's his name? Is it Ben Johnson?
Ben Johnson. So there'd be a statue of Ben Johnson put up wherever it was. And,
that's quite a deterrent, actually, isn't it?
It's good, isn't it?
It's a very good deterrent.
I think they should introduce that to all tournaments. You get red carded.
But here's a question about people who... So isn't there some suspicion that people change teams? So I was reading about a man called, I've got my piece of paper, Sotardes at the 99th Olympics. So first he competed for Crete and then he competed for Ephesus the next time. The Ephesians paid him to represent them because he was a star. He was an elite athlete. Then the Cretans banished him forevermore because they were so cross with him.
Yeah. And there's a further risk that you know, you might be banned because your city has committed some offense. So this happened to Sparta. In the last years of the Peloponnesian War, Sparta is the most powerful city in Greece, but the aliens banish them, so that they can't take part. And so various Spartan athletes kind of smuggle themselves in as pretend to be Thebans and so on.
So it's a bit like South African athletes in the 1980s, like Zola Budd or something.
Exactly. So there's absolute. So politics is all part of this kind of great snarl. So in a way, the most famous example of that, again, in the backdrop to the Peloponnesian War, this great war between Athens and Sparta, is Alcibiades, who is the kind of the golden boy of Athens, who plays a key role. He actually switches from Athens to Sparta at one point, then switches back to Athens. But at his kind of peak, as he's preparing the Athenian invasion of Sicily, to kind of signal the power of Athens, he goes to Olympia and he enters, I think it's 9 chariots in the chariot race, and he takes
the top three spots.
Yeah, well, it kind of is cheating, but you know, and there are lots of people who do think this is too much, but equally there are lots of people who are wowed by it, and it's remembered, and it's something that kind of, you know, lives on. So the chariot race is the first kind of adult race, that's obviously because that's going back to the race that Pelops has done. So it's kind of...
And that's a big highlight, isn't it, the chariot race?
Absolutely, massive highlight. And then you have the horse race. And again, Pelops has these horses. And if you go to Olympia, you go to the museum, the horses of Pelops are kind of, I mean, some of the most beautiful, terrifying sculptures you could ever see. They're breathtakingly... And they kind of evoke the power and the strangeness and the glamour and the terror of the games, I think, better than almost anything else that I can think of that survived from antiquity. They're incredibly powerful. And I think the Greeks felt that as well. So there was, particularly with the chariots, they were so dangerous. There was, when you turn, the risk is always that you're going to kind of, your chariot's going to splinter and then you're going to die. And it's said that there was a ghost that haunted that turning point. And nobody was quite sure who it was, but maybe it was Oinomaeus or Myrtilos or, you know, one of these guys in the myth. But this idea that there is a kind of curse, a ghost haunting it, I mean, it kind of adds jeopardy to it again. So you have the equestrian events in the morning of day two. Then you have the pentathlon, which again, it's kind of, it's absolutely the kind of the Greek ideal, really, that you're proficient at all these kind of various skills. Because if you're a runner, you want to be kind of slim. If you're taking part in the kind of the brawnier feats, then you want to be bulky. But the pantathlete is kind of, you know, the midpoint, the ideal of physicality.
Daley Thompson.
Yes, absolutely. And then you finish, and then day two comes to an end and you have a massive piss up. And that's where, so Alcibiades has brought all the kind of the gold fittings from Athens and he passes it off as his own. And vegetarians are catered for. So, so Empedocles, who's a vegetarian, he goes to the Olympics and he provides this kind of massive ox that's been baked in an oven, made of dough and garnished with herbs and spices and things.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, so that's nice to know, isn't it? And then and then obviously everyone is absolutely slaughtered. So they wake up, it's boiling hot, you can't possibly compete.
Yeah, can you imagine? I mean, they're sleeping in the tents with these colossal hangovers, the sun pounding down.
So do you know what you do need to see? If you wake up, it's incredibly hot and you've got a pounding hangover.
I'd go swimming personally. What do they do?
They slaughter 100 oxen in honor of Zeus.
Oh, I'm a bit of a lightweight by comparison, clearly.
Hecatomb. And it's kind of, well, we know it's disgusting because...
Just think of the flies and the stench of blood and all that.
Okay, so you make sacrifice to Zeus Apamweos, which means Zeus who keeps flies away.
Oh, right.
So the fact that
I don't believe that. I'm skeptical about whether that would work.
Apparently it did. So around the altar, apparently there were no flies. You may well express skepticism. But the altar, do you know what the altar was made of?
Dead pigs? God knows.
It's made of the ashes of the slaughtered oxen mixed with water into a paste. So it's a great lump of...
This just sounds the most terrible occasion imaginable.
Everyone says it's a terrible occasion. Too many crowds, too many flies, it's too hot, it's too disgusting. But everyone says it's amazing. So that's what makes me think of Glastonbury, because that's what people say. It's kind of, yes, this altar of Zeus is made up of the ashes of dead oxen.
If you said to me, is it not the kind of thing I can imagine somebody like Elon Musk doing? Yes, they not think?
Absolutely.
They're all going to be naked. They're going to be naked in pounding midsummer heat. There's going to be like flies everywhere, dead oxen.
Yeah, it's great. So you see, it's nothing really like the corporate...
No.
The corporate schmooze fest that is the modern.
Now let's see the IOC introduce some of these these proper traditions.
So you do that at the Temple of Zeus, you know, with its great statue by Phidias, who also does the Parthenon. Then you have day four, and this is the running. So you've got the middle distance run, you've got the sprint, you've got the long sprint, and then in the afternoon you've got the real crowd pleasers, which is the wrestling, and the boxing. And actually, you asked about getting burnt in the sun. So the wrestlers, I mean, they oil themselves and then they cover themselves in dust.
They're frying, surely, in the sun, aren't they? I mean, does the dust protect you? I mean, if all the oil.
Yeah, I guess. Really? I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, you're going to look very odd. You look like, what's his name in Apocalypse Now? Kind of rising up out of the mud.
Martin Sheen.
Martin Sheen, kind of. Terrifying.
I mean, but he had a heart attack while he was filming that. I mean, you wouldn't want that to happen at the Olympics.
Well, there you go. And the boxing and the pancration.
Yes.
Which is obviously an event that we don't have. The boxing, these are terrifyingly violent.
So somebody won the pancration when they were dead, I read. That they, what's his name? His name is Arichion.
Arichion from Arcadia.
He was choking his opponent or being choked, and he broke his opponent's...
He was getting throttled in a scissor grip.
But while being throttled, he broke his opponent's toe or something. His opponent said, I yield, or whatever.
And at that point, he died.
And everyone said, hurrah, Arichion has won. And the fact that he's dead is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great stuff. But and in many ways, the Pancratian is even... more terrifying because that you can literally do anything except gouge out your opponent's eye or bite him. So Mike Tyson would be disqualified. You can grab his testicles, squeeze
him. That's what I was going to say.
Absolutely.
You could do all that, but not biting.
Yeah.
I think they've got their priorities wrong, I think.
Wouldn't that be a great spectacle?
I mean, you're not naked yourself. You're not naked yourself as a spectator, are you?
No.
You're hungover and sunburned.
I'm thinking for TV.
Covered in flies, but you're not naked. And you're watching men twisting each other's testicles.
Well, hopefully you're watching. I mean, the crowds are massive. The stadium are too small to cope.
So you're standing behind other people watching men twisting their testicles.
You have to get there very early to get a vantage point. And then, of course, you've got the question of, you know, what do you do if you need a pee or...
Yeah, I mean, you get there really early.
Yourself.
The sun.
You just wet yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh God.
And then the final event is you running in armor. So you dress up in armor and run.
Well, that's ludicrous because, of course, in the Greek weather, 38 degrees centigrade or whatever.
But that's where the Spartans come into their own.
Right. That's so. They often win that, do they?
Yeah, the Spartans. I guess so. And then everyone goes, that's it. And the winners on the fifth day, they all go to the Statue of Zeus and they're given their olive crowns.
So, yeah, Tom, that sounds awful. And you have comprehensively shattered any romantic faith I had in the ancient Olympics. So one quick question before we get on to some great Olympians. It continues after Greece has been absorbed into the Roman Empire, but non-Greeks are taking part. That's right, isn't it? So Roman emperors... And other Romans. Now, is that general or is it just big names kind of VIPs?
It's basically Nero.
But didn't Tiberius take part?
He takes part in the equestrian event. But by and large, it remains focused on Greece. So it goes into decline. In the early Roman period, Sulla, who's this kind of terrifying general who marches on Rome and kind of. At the beginning of the first century BC, and he plunders Olympia and uses it to kind of fund his army in a civil war.
Yeah.
But then Augustus is very keen on it. Julius Claudius is very keen on it. Nero is massively keen on it. Hadrian, who is hugely into everything Greek, he's very keen on it. It's very successful through the second century. Third century, you get these Rome Empire kind of implodes into civil war, barbarians sweep across, goes into decline. And basically, by the fourth century, it's on its last legs, and it kind of I think the last recorded mention of the games is I think 394 something like that.
Yeah, Theodosius the Great, isn't it? Doesn't Theodosius ban it? Basically,
I'm not sure he bans it. I think basically there's no market for it
because everybody has become Christian.
Everyone's become Christian, so nobody's going for
So that sort of reinforces that point about it being religious rather than sporting, or sporting being religious. That they see it as a pagan festival. You know, the flies and the nudity aren't enough to compensate for the pagan religious connotations.
Well, Paul, when he writes to the Corinthians, makes reference to the Isthmian Games. So he says that as Christians we are competing for a higher crown.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, so his dissing of the games is there in the New Testament. If you're not worshipping Zeus, then what's the point? And the great statue of Zeus has been carted off to Constantinople. It's been taken there not as a kind of religious icon, but as a kind of cultural symbol. There's just no call for them.
Tell me about some Olympic. Have you got some good Olympians up your sleeve, or some Olympic facts, or something to?
Yeah. So the ones who tend to live on are boxers and wrestlers. I think because they kind of evoke the spirit of Heracles. So there's one who is said to be the son of Heracles, a guy called Theagenes, who comes from the island of Thasos. In the north of the Aegean, and he's interesting in the context of the episodes that went out last week about statues.
Yeah,
because as a young boy, he was very keen on he'd pick up statues and carry them around. Just because he was so strong, he was kind of seven. He'd just pick up a statue and get told off and have to take it back. When he died, he's a kind of great hero, and they make a statue of him, put it up in the marketplace in Thasos. And this is awful for another Thasian who had gone to the Olympics and had failed. And so this guy goes and kind of pisses and writes graffiti on the statue and generally insults it. And the statue gets really cross about this and kind of warns this guy off, says, you know, watch it. And this guy carries on. So eventually the statue keels over and crushes him to death.
Wow. That's an omen for today's statue
of Obes. Yes, I mean, there's warning there. And the sons of the guy who's been crushed to death are so cross about this that they abduct the statue and dump it in the sea. And then everything goes wrong for Thasos. Just terrible. Everything goes wrong. So they send an emissary to Delphi. And Delphi says, you know, you have great Theagenes unremembered. You have cancelled Theagenes.
Wow, I wish I'd known this before we did our statue walk, Tom. This is great stuff.
So they have to uncancel him. Yeah. So a bit like getting Colston out of the bay. They have to go to where he's been dumped and dredge him up and put him back up on his pedestal.
So to rename all these William Gladstone halls of residence that have been...
Exactly. Yes. So there's a kind of... he's famous. But I think that the great hero, the really famous one, is a guy called Milo, who comes from Croton, which is in Sicily. So one of those colonies that you were talking about. He's a wrestler. He wins 5 in a row. You know, I mean, that's kind of unheard of. And he's so strong that he can tie a cord around his head and then just kind of flex and it just bursts the cord.
I reckon I can do that.
So that's his party trick.
I reckon I can do that. I mean, I'm not going to do it live for the Rest is History listeners to watch, but I'm going to try later tonight.
But you could do it now. I could describe it if you want to do it now.
I have no cord to hand.
Oh, that's a shame. What a shame. But also, he had a diet for heroes. So do you know his elite sports diet?
Probably pork, judging by the content of this podcast.
20 pounds of meat a day.
20 pounds?
20 pounds of bread a day. 2 gallons of wine.
Wow. That's very kind of Elvis sort of diet.
Well, Bill Werbenick, the... the snooker player. Didn't he have 20 pints before he could?
Oh, Andy the Viking Fordham, who I think isn't he the Viking? He's just left us, sadly. Darts player.
So Milo is the kind of model for all these. But he had a very entertaining sports death. So he was out and he saw a kind of tree that had been split to dry it out. And there were kind of pegs holding the two halves apart. And he thought, just for fun, he'd take the pegs out and put his hand in. And he put his hand in and the two halves of the tree kind of snapped around it and he couldn't pull his hand out.
Okay.
So he was stuck with this tree and he got eaten by a pack of wolves.
Wow. That's no way to go, is it?
No.
So I mean, all his strength availed him naught.
It availed him. And so it kind of horrible deaths is another way in which these Olympic figures are kind of heroic. You know, they are heroes in the Greek sense rather than in the kind of, you know, Marcus Rashford sense.
Yeah.
There's another one, Polydamas, who was a great kind of winner in the Pancratian, who killed lions with his bare hands, who he would capture bulls and pull off their hooves.
That's just bad behavior.
and he was with some friends in a cave. There was an earthquake. He held the cave up while they all got out and then got crushed to death. So that was him.
That's
a proper hero, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. That's actually quite heroic.
But the most sinister one, and the one who is literally proclaimed a hero by the Delphic Oracle, is a guy called Cleomedes. And again, he's another of these guys who kills his opponent in the games. And he gets disqualified by this for the judges because killing your opponent is seen as being too much.
Yeah.
He goes mad with this disqualification. He goes back to his home island. And do you know what he does there?
I don't.
He pulls down a school and there are 60 boys in it and they all get killed.
Oh, my God.
And so the parents are understandably cross about this. And they chase him through the streets. But because he's Olympian, he can run very fast. So he gets up to a temple of Athena, locks himself in the temple. And they're all banging away. And he hides in a chest. And they burst in. And they smash open the chest. And he's vanished. He's gone.
Wow. He has... Yeah, that's quite a party trick.
So they obviously send a messenger to Delphi to try and find out what's happened. And the Delphic Oracle says he is the last hero. Offer him sacrifice. He is no longer mortal. And I think that in a way is the kind of paradigmatic account of, he's the paradigmatic Olympic hero because he literally becomes a god. And there's that incredible element of darkness to it that I think is, you know, is a constant part of these games.
That's an extraordinary story because it's such a terrible story.
It is a terrible story.
So he's in no way punished for his killing of all these kids in this school. That's just seen as an absolutely reasonable way of
It's not seen as reasonable. It's seen as terrible. But Heracles, for instance, I mean, he kills his own children. He's driven mad by the gods. And that sense that men of phenomenal strength are prone to go mad and do terrible things, that's part of what the Olympic Games are all about. And the people who are remembered are often remembered for feats of kind of hideous violence.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because our image of the Greeks and the Olympics, certainly our image of the ancient Olympics, and our image of ancient Greece is this sort of pristine marble, heroic sporting spirit, heroic using in the sort of modern sense, this sort of almost this lost golden age of, you know, milk and honey or whatever. And clearly the Greek world is so much darker and more sinister than we commonly think. And when we use it as a stick to beat ourselves and to beat the modern Olympics, commercialized and tawdry and sold out and all the rest of it. I mean, in some ways, the modern Olympics are much more cuddly and sort of...
Well, they're more antiseptic,
yeah.
I think. But they lack that... They lack soul, I guess is what I would say.
Yes, I think that's reasonable.
I think the ancient games are dark and terrible, and that's why they last as long as they do. I mean, they last over 1,000 years.
Immeasurably longer than the modern Olympics.
And they do that because they're holding a mirror up to something very, very profound and fundamental in the way that the Greeks see themselves and their relationship with gods and the cosmos and fate and what it is to be human. And I think that, again and again, whenever you have an aspect of Greece that seems to us modern, that seems familiar, it isn't. So democracy would be another example. You know, the Athenian understanding of democracy is immeasurably alien to us. And the fact that we have the same, you know, the same word can apply to the system that the Athenians had and the system that we have disguises the way that it's immeasurably different. And the same is absolutely true of the Olympics. So the project of revitalizing the Olympics was an absolute pipe dream. They were never going to manage to do that.
So that's been a fascinating glimpse into actually a much darker world and frankly more off-putting world than I anticipated. So I think now that we've, you know, got into the sordid underbelly of the ancient Olympics, we should do the same with the modern Olympics in our next podcast. And we should do things like, you know, the Munich Olympics, the disaster in Montreal, Moscow and LA and so on. The origins of the Olympics, of course. Hitler's Olympics. Exactly. We're going to do all that. So there'll be tons to discuss then, and it won't be quite so sacral. And fewer flies.
There'll be fewer flies, and it won't be sacral. So you'll be safe.
Yes. Okay. Great. So we will see you all next time, I guess. Tom?
See you soon.
Eferisto? Yep. Yesus?
Yep. See you, Dominic. See you back. Well, have a safe flight back, and I hope you don't get put into a hotel for 10 days at Heathrow.
Thank you. That's more of a threat than a hope, I think, from you. I hope you're going to be straight onto the border force when the recording is over.
Seize that man.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye, everyone. Bye-bye.